Our third speaker today is Ron Haskins. He's a senior fellow in the Economic Studies program at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C. He also co-directs Brookings Center on Children and Families. During his career, he spent 14 years on the staff of the House Ways and Means Resource Subcommittee. He was previously a senior advisor to the President for Welfare Policy at the White House. He was editor of the 1996, 1998, and 2000 editions of the Green Book. Each of these books is 1,600 pages. They analyze the nation's social programs in areas like healthcare and poverty and unemployment. He's currently a senior editor of The Future of Children. This is a journal on policy issues that affect children and families. And he's published widely on child care, child protection, child support enforcement, marriage, welfare reform, and so on. In 2009, he published a book, Creating an Opportunity Society, with Isabel Sawhill. 2008, he published Getting Ahead or Losing Ground, Economic Mobility in America, a book published with Isaacs and Sawhill. He's had several awards for his work. I'll just mention a couple. He was named one of the 100 most influential people in federal government by the National Journal. He received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement and the President's Award for Outstanding Contributions from the American Public Human Services Association. He's worked as a university researcher, high school social studies teacher, and a non-commissioned officer in the Marines. So he's going to talk about the research literature today on effective jobs programs, but he has some personal experience as well. His father and his wife were both involved in businesses, and one of his four children, his daughter, owns her own business. So his topic today is evidence-based jobs programs. What works? What doesn't? Ron.
Well, thank you for that nice introduction. It takes me about maybe 5 minutes to overcome such a fine introduction, but you'll watch me do it. My mom taught me to ingratiate myself with an audience whenever I gave a public speech, and I noticed that Bill did a very good job because he left out the St. Louis part of his background. So I just want you all to know I was raised primarily in Michigan. Almost everybody in my family went to University of Michigan. And I am a fanatical Michigan fan. And we are destined to play you in the Big Ten Championship, so I hope you have lots of injuries during the regular season. I used to have a pie chart that I used, and I used it once with the trustees at the prestigious Brookings Institution. And the pie chart was supposed to be the factors that influence public policy decision-making by people like the folks in this room. And it had a big part of the pie was for political philosophy, another part for the position of the party, another part for the chairman's position, the lobbyist position, constituents' desires, and so forth. And I had a little teeny slice, the kind that I used to get when my mom made cherry pie and all my brothers ate it, and I'd get this little teeny slice, and that was for evidence. And after 25 years in Washington and 14 years working directly with the Congress and a year in the White House, that pie, slice of the pie, got smaller and smaller and smaller. And when I first went to Washington 30 years ago, my goal was to be there for 1 year. I went on a fellowship, and I was going to study how social science research was used to formulate public policy and go back to the University of North Carolina and write the definitive book on the use of evidence to shape public policy. 30 years ago, I did that. I never went back to the University of North Carolina. I never wrote the book, and probably a wise decision because, although now I have to say, and this is my kind of a mini thesis in the first part of my talk, and that is that evidence is becoming more important, and I think there's a lot of indication that evidence is more important. And so I want to devote the first part of my talk before I talk about specific work-based studies that I think have produced very remarkable results, so remarkable that if policymakers like you actually base policies on the results of these studies, I think we'd be way ahead. We'd be better with employment. We'd handle the kind of problems that have been discussed wonderfully by both Jonas and Bill. So let's see. This thing, what makes it go forward? Let's see if I can do it. Yeah, okay. Good, all right. So I want to talk about, from the perspective of policymakers like people in this room, three approaches that are actually taking place at the federal level. I noticed that they really started to get rolling under the Bush administration, and the Obama administration has continued them. So I think there's a lot of reason to think this is bipartisan. I hope it's bipartisan, and I would look for improved policymaking in the future if it is. So I'm going to talk about three things. There are probably others, but three things that are really important. The first one is making evidence-based decisions on grants. This is a huge issue for the federal government because the federal government gives lots of grants to the states. You know, we all are familiar with the Brandeis rule that the states are the experimental location of democracy. And I think to a great extent that's true. But nonetheless, we give a lot of grants, the federal government does, to the states without clear directions and without evaluation, and a lot of that money gets wasted. Title I would be of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, now No Child Left Behind, is the greatest example because we've had, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars distributed to states under Title I, and evaluations cannot show that there's an impact for that money. There may be, but it's not showing up. So we need to have a better way to make grants, and I think to some extent the same thing is true at the state level, because state policymakers have huge impacts on the counties and cities around the state, and they might be able to do the same thing. So the first thing is to make sure that money is funded for programs that work, and that's what we have built, I would say, in the last 20 years or so. And in fact, part of the revolution in evidence in social policy has been, I think it's beginning was in the scholarly world, and we have many scholars here today, some of whom, like Tim Smeeting, an old friend of mine, and I do mean an old, have developed the techniques and the methods to really do good evaluations. We can tell if programs work because we have lots of technology, use of computers, use of sophisticated data analysis methods, and above all, something called random assignment experiments that we really can't tell if programs work. And so on the first thing, if we made sure that we spent money on programs that have evidence that they succeed, that would be a huge step in the right direction. And then the second thing is we need to have continuous evaluation of those programs. Another thing we've learned over the years is that programs that are very good and work in, you know, in Muskegon, Michigan, when you bring them to Wisconsin, they might not work. So there's something that happens, even though the model is potentially effective, when it's actually implemented at the local level, sometimes it doesn't work as well. Childcare is a great example of that. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. So we need to have a continuous evaluation. We need to insist that people that get our money, either the federal to the states or states to the localities, that they continuously evaluate their programs and submit good evidence about whether they're being successful or not. So those are the first things about evidence-based grant making. The second is what works clearinghouses. Let's see, I make this thing go forward again. Let me go back for just a second. I just want to mention these for a minute. The Obama administration, again following up on the Bush administration, you don't need to see these words. I just want you to show that they're, I'd say this is on the order of $3 billion, or could be. Not all the money's been appropriated yet. And this money is going to states that agree to do this kind of evidence-based policymaking in six areas, in teen pregnancy, in home visiting, both of which have lots and lots of evidence of program models that work very well. And in fact, the administration actually commissioned literature reviews by a big research organization called Mathematica to identify the models that states could employ when they got this money from the federal government to build this network of programs, both for reducing teen pregnancy and for home visiting to get kids off on the right foot, kids who are born to poor families. Then also there's one called Social Innovation, which is a community-based program, and there's one called Investing in Innovation. The money was just recently given out for innovative programs like Teach for America, the KIPP program. I think there are a total of something like 59 programs or 49 programs that have gotten money, all of which begin with strong evidence that they can be successful. If they are well implemented at the state and local level, they will succeed and produce positive impacts. And then two that are work-based, the Community College Challenge Fund and the, I can't read the last one, but it's a innovation fund for the workforce, very similar to the Social Innovation Fund that some of you may be familiar with that the administration has already funded. Neither one of those are well-developed. One of them actually has money, and in fact, it's interesting that they took money, the administration and the House and the Senate went along with them, which I felt was quite shocking. They took money out of the Workforce Investment Act and in order to fund this, which suggests that the Congress realized that, like Title I, the Workforce Investment Act was too loose, did not give enough direction to the states, and the states were not necessarily using the money well. I don't know if that's true. Some of you in this room may well disagree with that, especially people here who are in your Department of Labor. But that is how that's being funded, and it was funded on a bipartisan basis. So I think there is some feeling that we ought to focus more, both Republicans and Democrats, we need to focus more on evidence-based policymaking and insist that when the federal government gives money to the states, and the same thing could be true of the states and the localities, that the money is invested in programs that have evidence of success. What works clearinghouses? Now, what is a what works clearinghouse? It's usually a website, and it has lots of fascinating information about programs that work. And it documents the evidence that these programs work. It describes the programs in some detail. These are very useful, especially for staffers, your staffers, and I have a number of members at the federal level actually themselves look at these sites to find out what programs work for certain problems. I think we have something like 10 of these at the federal level. Some of them are in drug prevention programs. There are several in education, a very, very good education clearinghouse that's part of the Institute of Education Sciences. There are also, the Department of Justice has one, especially for teen programs that prevent teen violence and teen arrests. So the idea here is we don't have to reinvent the wheel. A lot of work has been done. We have lots of good models that legislators and people that are funding programs could use to begin with a model that works well in many of these different areas. And this is part of what I think has really changed over the last 10 or 15 years. It's more and more programs that have evidence that they succeed, and the evidence is strong and solid. If they can be implemented well at other places, they will work. So a clearinghouse can play an important role in that, and as I just explained why they're important. And there's a good example, the What Works Clearinghouse, that's part of the Institute of Education Sciences, which is part of the Department of Education. I strongly recommend that you look at that or have your staff look at it, because it has all kinds of, all you think of important problem in education today, and they're good model programs that have shown success based on solid evaluations that they work. The third step is, this is difficult, and I don't know if Wisconsin has something like this or how many states do, but it's growing increasingly at the federal level. The Bush administration really focused on this a lot, and Obama, much to my surprise, has even intensified the focus. In fact, this reminds me of a funny story about Wisconsin, about Tommy Thompson. Some of you may know when he became Secretary of HHS, he used to talk about having to kiss the ring, get down on your knees, he said, and kiss the ring of the head of the Office of Management and Budget. And there's some truth in that. I was in the White House at the time, and I can remember a lot of people in the White House had a little chagrin over Tommy Thompson out there telling the press that, you know, he had to kiss the ring of the head of OMB. But the truth of the matter is that OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, does have a lot of influence over the congressional agencies. And I'm sure everybody in this room understands when a new administration comes in, the first thing they want to do is capture the bureaucracy so they'll actually implement the programs the way the new administration wants them administered. And that's what Tommy was referring to. He wanted to do things his own way, didn't want to be controlled by the Office of Management and Budget. But here's what the Office of Management Budget has been doing. And as I say, it started under the Bush administration. Bush organized something called the PART, the Program Assessment Rating Tool. And they made the agencies that implement programs specify the goals and the evidence that those goals were being achieved for all of their major programs. And they did it every year. And then they would meet with officer to Office of Management Budget to talk about how they were doing these evaluations. So it was an attempt to make sure that the agencies were actually evaluating their programs, that they knew what they were trying to achieve with the programs. And I can tell you, when they first started, there were a number of programs you could not necessarily figure out what the goals of these programs were. You could, in some broad, you know, kind of ethereal sense, but to actually say this program is intending to educate kids in this way or to achieve to this level, they didn't have goals like that. And so that changed, and then OMB started to focus on evidence, and Obama improved it by actually giving agencies more money if they were doing good evaluations. So I think that this is a tool for policymakers, especially in the administrative branch, but I think that the legislative branch can insist on this sort of thing by the administrative branch, that they begin to produce evidence, that they can show that they're spending their money on effective programs and that they're getting results. And again, the evidence base of this is one, the crucial part. It's the brick that establishes the base of this approach, and I think it can be very effective, and I think it's up to state legislators to really make this work. Now I want to talk just briefly about four examples of evidence-based policy, all of which have a good research base. Some of them have a massive research base, and all of which are pertinent in one way or another to the theme of this morning session, which is employment. And the first, of course, is preschool programs. This is just a collection of data that one of the great experts in preschool education, Steve Barnett, who heads the National Institute of Early Education Research. And it's from three of the classic programs, the Chicago Parent-Child Center, which was a fairly big program and had over 500 people, and smaller scale programs. We know a lot about the Abecedarian program and the Perry Preschool program. And what it shows is that there are long-term impacts, not just on the kids' school performance, but on how they do after school. So there's reduced incidence of teen pregnancy in some of the studies. There's reduced incidence of teen violence and teen arrests. There are even reduced arrest records as adults. There's more employment. Here at the bottom, I have the estimates of impact on earnings of adults that were in the programs. And these are all programs that had random assignment, had all the features of good studies, and followed people until the oldest kids are now 45. So we really do really good evidence that if we could have quality preschool for all our kids, and especially poor kids, I think there's developing agreement in the field that poor kids are especially like to, because they're the ones that need the kind of influence that leads to better school achievement and leads to more learning. And if they can get that in the preschool years, it helps them greatly and has impacts throughout their, not only their school history, but their adulthood. But I want to emphasize this to you. I can't tell you how many times I sat in the Ways and Means Committee and listened to witnesses come and testify about how great preschool is, and if you only allocate this money, all these wonderful things are going to happen. That is not true. And the reason it's not true is this old bugaboo of implementation. We have way too many mediocre, just like the public schools. We have way too many mediocre programs. We're not getting the impact with our investments that we should be able to get. We have to have higher quality, especially classroom teachers. That's where the action really is. We need better preschool teachers. And until we get that, I think we're going to get the kind of results that we're getting right now, forgive me forever for saying this, from Head Start. Because I think our results from Head Start are mediocre at best. And we're spending, you know, $7 billion a year in this program, 950,000 kids in the program, and we could be getting a lot better returns. And these studies show that the potential to get these returns is there, but we're not realizing because we don't have high-quality programs. So that's a huge role, I think, for state legislators and for state administrative agencies to improve the quality of preschool programs. The second example is the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. I know less about this. In fact, I just learned about it about 2 months ago, so I've been reading up on this thing. We have it in Wisconsin. Every state has it. There's an organization called the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, and the concept of it is really fits right in with what we've been talking about here. Especially small and medium-sized companies, of which we have something like 3 million companies in the United States with between 1 and 4 employees, and they are often very inefficient. And in many cases, if they can get help with issues of technology, about improving their production, about better use of technology, about training, about management, they can greatly improve their efficiency, improve their profits, do a much better job, and often grow and hire more employees, which is, you know, that's our desperate need right now. And they get these from, there are actually 2,500 people that are involved in this MEP, the Manufacturing Extension Program, a partnership, and they send these experts there to help the local employer improve their business model, improve their day-to-day operation, improve their training, and so forth. And there have been at least 2 quite good studies of these programs, and they show that for investing about $1,500 on average, it produces 1 new job. And there's even one study that shows that the return on investment is $30 for every dollar invested in this program. Numbers like that often strike me as magic. I'm not sure that is really, but it is an impressive program. And it's an example of what we can do, and in fact, is going on right here in Wisconsin now. And if we had more of it, I think it would produce even better impacts and could play a role in increasing employment. The third program I want to talk about is sectoral employment. This, I had never met Jonas and Bill until I came. Well, last night I met them at dinner for the first time. I had no idea what they were going to say today. This is like I'm, you know, the choir echoing exactly what they said. The key to sectoral employment, and we now have several experiments, a random assignment, multiple sites, all the features of the very best evaluation studies. And the key is that these programs focus on the local employer, find out what the local employer needs, and then they try to help people. The average age of the people in these programs is 32, disproportionately minority, mostly poorly educated, so they're exactly the kind of people that both previous speakers talked about that we're worried about. They don't have very good experience in the labor market. And if you teach them these specific skills that are in demand in the local economy, you have major impacts on the probability. Look at this. So here is the impact on their work by month. This random assignment, so very good scientific studies. And the purple area shows you the difference. This is the impact of how well these programs can increase, and this is the hours of work per month, and then here are the impacts on income. And so they work more, they earn more money, employers are more satisfied, and the essence, the active ingredient here is this coordination, exactly as the previous two speakers said, between the employer and the trainer. You've got to train people for jobs that are available in the local economy. If you don't do that, you're wasting your money. And I think this has traditionally been one of the great criticisms of our employment and training programs. That we, back in the 80s, I remember we must have trained 5 million hairdressers and paid federal and state dollars to do it. Every person in the United States, man and woman, could have had a personal hairdresser because of all the training that was going on to help people become hairdressers. So matching the employers and the trainers is really critical. And the fourth example, Career Academies, is an even better example because it's an even better study, and it has one surprising finding that even goes beyond the results that Bill told you. So here's the intervention for Career Academies. We've had thousands of these around the country now. This evaluation is based on random assignment to experimental and control, multiple sites, and follow the kids for 8 years after they graduate. This is the very best kind of research. And here's what they did. First, they put them in smaller schools. They broke down the schools. Often they couldn't put them in a separate building, so they divided the building up because they felt the kids needed more individual attention. Secondly, exactly as Bill described, they changed the curriculum so that the curriculum had a major emphasis on what in the old days when I was a kid we called industrial arts. So they did both academic and industrial arts. And then the third thing, and this is really the key, again, exactly as Bill said, the kids got an experience, sometimes 3 years of experience, actually with an employer. Not that they necessarily worked in the job, but they went regularly to a work location so they could meet people who were working. They learned the importance of being on time. They learned the importance of taking supervision. All of these basic, what we usually now call soft skills, that they acquired while they were in high school. And now you follow them for 8 years after they graduate. And here you can see an impact on family earnings. This is monthly. The impacts were primarily on males, which is very unusual. Most of the things we do, the impacts are mainly on females. These are mainly on males. And over the course of that 8-year follow-up, those males earned $30,000 more on average. $30,000 over 8 years. I am not familiar with any intervention that has this kind of impact on a group of people, that many of whom are destined to be in this group that we're concerned about, drop out of school and so forth. And secondly, listen to this. One of the great criticisms of this kind of education is that you close the door. Bill mentioned this. Because they're going to work at manufacturing stuff. They're not going to go to college. The college attendance rates for the kids that were in the career academies were identical to the college attendance rate for the kids who weren't. So this experience of being in the labor force and getting a work experience during high school not only translated to more work, more hours of work, and more income, but the kids were equally likely to get a post-secondary degree. So it did not have the impact that people were mainly concerned about. So I think there's no doubt if we invest money in career academies and do a better job, and again, exactly as both previous speakers said, we would reduce our high school dropout rate, we would have kids much more prepared for employment in the economy that we have now, they would be more likely to get a job, and they would be more likely to earn a good living. And one last effect here that's really a surprise, I believe this is the only random assignment study that has ever shown that it had an impact on marriage rates and the rates that the males lived with the mother, usually their wife, not always, they weren't always married, but a huge impact on marriage, which if you think about it makes sense because women are, they make choices and guys make choices. And one thing women look at is, does a guy earn a living? And these guys had more money, so they were more likely to get married, more likely to have babies, and more likely to live with their babies. So that's a really important impact that had nothing to do with the goals of the study, but it followed naturally from the impact on employment and earnings. So it's a wonderful result. This is the earnings impacts, and I think they can have access to all this stuff, so you can look at it carefully. Really remarkable results. So let me summarize with just 2 points. The first one is that I think that legislatures and administrative agencies need to do a much better job of making sure that dollars are spent on programs that we have evidence that they work. The number of programs that we have that kind of evidence about is expanding. Every year we have new examples of programs that work. You can still have plenty of flexibility, people state or local level, because they have lots of choices of programs. And that they ought to evaluate what they're doing. We ought to have regular routine evaluations to make sure that we're getting what we're paying for. And the second thing is, I didn't talk about this, but I think it's a really crucial conclusion, and that is that we need to make sure that we continue to fund the kind of research that shows that we can develop more and more programs that work and have the impacts that we want, especially in the area of education and increasing employment opportunities for our young people. Thank you. Can we take some questions?
Yeah. Did you mention that sector strategy? One of them is right here in Milwaukee.
Oh, okay. Karen, why don't you mention that on the sectoral strategy, there were three, in fact, this is in the notes if you want to look at the slideshow. One of them was in Milwaukee,
yeah.
And a very effective program. So there's an example right here in Wisconsin in the sectoral strategy of matching up what the employer actually wants and what the trainer does in the training.
Yeah.
Questions?
Yep, questions for Dr. Haskins. And again, we'll give priority to legislators and secretary's office staff. Questions for Dr. Haskins.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Janet Buley. Useful is it to extrapolate on some of the best findings? I'm thinking of the manufacturing partnerships. And is it fair, or is it at least a good place to start to build upon conceptually? I'm thinking of these sorts of partnerships to go a little bit beyond just manufacturing. So when we're in a study like this, can we take those findings and then try to build on them, change them, or is it best to start at the beginning? Because I would love to expand that concept to go beyond manufacturing.
No, I think both are important, but expanding on things that already work, and by the way, in almost all of the experimental approaches I'm talking about here, the evidence-based policies, some of the money is allocated to do exactly what you're talking about. The assumption is not that we've already made all the discoveries we need and we know the program models that work. That's where we should spend most of our money. But it would be a mistake to spend all of it there because we can develop new approaches exactly in the way that you just described. And so if I were a state legislator, I would always keep some of the money to try new things, to try experimental things. And in many cases, it's better to start with something that already works. And especially when you're dealing with different groups of people. If you have a higher population of minorities, for example, in a certain site, as opposed to, say, a rural site, you're probably going to have to have a very different kind of program. So there are adjustments like that that we need to learn a lot more about. So yes, we should do exactly what you say, but we should always start, I think, or usually start with something that works. Other question?
Other questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Tim. I'm going to give. our priority is Tim knows Ron personally. He can talk to him.
Yes, and he's about ready to get even with me for my comment about him being old.
When you started talking about the anti-brewer stuff, and especially about Michigan, it only took you 5 seconds to lose all that great stuff. Ron's been a friend for a long time, and I think I reviewed his book, which I think is great, Creating an Opportunity in Society. And I think he hit on a number of very important things in his talk. First of all, things like the nurse home visiting, teen pregnancy prevention, and good quality preschools. This is important. That takes money. And we're going to have to find that money somewhere. When I reviewed Ron's book, he and Bell have a set of $20 billion worth of things that make a big difference.
21.
21.
Yeah.
And I pointed out,
I lost a lot of Republican friends with those recommendations.
I pointed out the good news and the bad news in the healthcare industry, which is last year we spent $44 billion more on Medicare than the year before, twice as much as you need for these programs. So while the good news is that there are a lot of jobs out there in healthcare, the bad news is that it's liable to be crippling the rest of us. And that the real issue is to get a hold of that. But the other thing that Ron said that I think is very, very important and was said by the other speakers too, employers have to get in the game. Bill's colleague and my good friend Dick Murnane has something he calls Career Academies Light. That's where Career Academies hasn't worked because there is no connection to the employer. The businesses have to be in it. They have to say what we need, what we expect, and how we're going to get from here to there, and then the schools and community organizations need to respond.
Let me make a quick point about funding these programs, and this is bound to be immensely unpopular with this audience. It's a bigger problem at the federal level than at the state level, but it's a huge problem both places. We spend so much money on programs for the elderly. Tim mentioned Medicare, but we spend a lot of money in other programs too. And if you look at the projections, almost every time when I speak around the country, I have my first slide shows the future of financing of our programs. And we're headed toward, by 2080, if we keep going just the way we are now, we will spend 300% of our GDP, 300% of our GDP on interest. And the number one thing driving interest is Medicare. We just absolutely, there's a great economist named Herman Stein, who said, any trend that can't continue won't. So at some point, we are going to get a hold of Medicare. And I don't know if it's going to be rationing. I don't know. I think premium support could play a role. But my point is, we should finance new investments in children's programs and the kind of programs we talk about here by reducing our spending on programs for the elderly, which will be bound to get you reelected.
Are you sure of that?